Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We've come to 2 Samuel chapter 7. If you want to know a person, you really don't know them by their station in life, by their degrees or pedigrees. You don't know them by their fame or fortune, by what they possess and what not. The far better indicator of who a person really is to know their convictions, their priorities, and their values in life. Those drive their behaviors. And that really defines the person as a spiritual and moral being, what really matters. Right off in this chapter, chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, the godly heart of David shines forth once all the dust had settled in solidly establishing his kingdom and capital, and once he had succeeded in bringing the ark, the symbol of God's presence among his people, into Jerusalem, the capital city of the nation. David now begins to feel a sense of shame. It's a sense of shame that he himself resided in a kingly palace, but here's the ark of the Lord was housed in only a tent. It is as if David said to himself, is there something wrong with this picture? And he concluded that such an arrangement was unfitting to that which symbolized the sacred presence. Now it came about when the king lived in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, the court prophet at this time, see now, here I dwell in the house of cedar, which means the very best, but the ark of God dwells within tent curtains. Nathan said to the king, go, do all that is in your mind, for the Lord is with you. But it came about the same night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan, and the Lord said to Nathan, go and say to my servant David, thus says the Lord, are you the one who should build me a house to dwell in? I have not dwelt in a house, that is, a fixed residence, a temple, since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day. I have been moving about in a tent, even a tabernacle. Wherever I have gone, he means symbolically, of course, God's not confined to a tent, wherever I have gone with all the sons of Israel, did I ever speak a word with any one of the tribes of Israel which I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, Thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture and from following the sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. I've been with you wherever you've gone. I've cut off all your enemies from before you. This has been my work, not yours. And I will make you a great name like the names of the great men who are upon the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again, nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly. Now this is going to be a long way down the road. That has not happened yet. Even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all of your enemies. This is an end times prophecy. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. When your days are complete and you lie down with your father, Nathan tells David, speaking for the Lord, I will raise up your descendant after you. The language here is such that it has to refer in part to David's greater son, the Messiah. I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That could not have been Solomon, Rehoboam, or any of the others. Now, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, now the prophecy regresses to David's strictly human successors. I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. That's messianic. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. Those are called the sure mercies of David. The Lord had never ordered that the ark be quartered in a grandiose temple. Rather, it was David's sense of the holiness of God that internally demanded that the ark should be housed in something more impressive than a portable tent. That kind of arrangement may have been expedient in Israel's wilderness wandering, where the ark was so often on the move and its quarters had to be portable. But now, after all these years in Canaan, after a monarchy had been established, and after a central capital had been established, to David it seemed no longer becoming that the residence of the ark of God should be so humble and overshadowed by the insignia of royalty all around it. Somehow, its trappings, he thought, ought to reflect, so far as human art and wealth could help, a far more impressive sense of the transcendence of God in its structure and design than a mere tent. This sensitivity on the part of David, and his desire to rectify this disparity and anomaly, impresses me at least. Clearly, the king had not allowed himself to become so full of himself and his royal station, as so often happens to people who gain great power, celebrity, and wealth. He did not allow himself to become forgetful of God, never allowed himself to become forgetful of his dependence upon the Lord for raising David to such heights, establishing and protecting him against all of his enemies. His humility at this point is fully intact. So David naturally broaches this idea to Nathan, one of God's faithful prophets and a counselor to the king. Nathan immediately, but I'll have you note prematurely, endorsed David's proposal to build a temple, more symbolically befitting the glory of the Lord, in which to house the ark. Nathan said, verse 3, go and do all that is in your mind. That's a great idea. The Lord is with you. But Nathan, note, had jumped the gun a bit, with all the best intentions in the world. It seemed for all the world that David's vision was spot on. It seemed that it was intended and would in fact honor God. The only problem was that, as it turned out, it was not God's desire for David himself to be the builder of the temple. That would be Solomon, David's son. He would be given the green light from God to construct it. Now, in this section, we can extract in principle what I think are some very good lessons by way of application. First, insofar as our motive is to honor God, to project through our physical works his glorious attributes, I think, consider this, that it's good and right that we should spare no expense in doing so. Where it all goes wrong in our building projects is when we go out and build magnificent churches with money more or less robbed from the poor, and or we are in reality building great monuments to ourselves, we pastors and church leaders not to honor God, but to pander to our own human pride. Motive has a lot to do with it. Many, I think, would agree with me that some of these grand cathedrals communicate a sense of God's transcendence and holiness like nothing else of a physical nature. Personally, I think that's worth a lot. David thought so, too. You remember how in Exodus chapter 28, verse 2, the specifications for priestly garments were, quote, for glory and beauty. I personally think there is something to be said for making the things that represent the sacred for glory and for beauty as far as possible. Certainly, the art of worship is no substitute for the heart of worship. But if the heart is there, the art is enhancing. I believe also that if the heart is there, that the heart is inclined, where possible, to offer that worship in forms and settings, as well as in spirit, that reflects and projects the awesomeness of our great God. There is something about the grandeur of these great churches and cathedrals that seems to command a certain humility and spirit of reverence. I'm not big on a lot of pomp and circumstance, but I'll tell you, if I had the money, it would not offend my sensibilities a bit to go build a grand church like they used to build, that you walk in it, and there is in the architecture, the atmosphere, a sense of God's transcendence. There's much that I disagree with Roman Catholicism about, and I have some dear Roman Catholic people who listen to this program, and with all due respect to them and their sensibilities, there is much in Roman Catholic doctrine that I deplore. However, Roman Catholics over the years have had a sense and communicated that sense through their churches and their architecture, something that modern Protestants have largely lost sight of, and that's the transcendence of God. We are so big on the immanence of God, that is, His presence among us, and that is good, that's not wrong, but we've gone to the opposite extreme. The trouble in their environments is that they don't communicate much of the immanence of God, in my opinion. It's just the polar opposite, and both are wrong. But man, I'm just speaking very personally, I would like to do that. I would just love to have the millions necessary to do that. Not as a monument to ourselves, not something that we can look back and say, that is our church, that kind of thing. But something that when you walk into is awe-inspiring, and something that just kind of creates a sense of our own littleness when we walk into it. It just symbolically communicates a kind of holiness and a kind of awe. Yes, I like the stained glass and all of that. You can go to extremes in any direction, but I think we've gone to extremes in the other direction. But it doesn't communicate any sense of that. And that's what David had such a high view of God. He said, look, and many of us, we live in fine homes and all of that. And David said, there's something wrong with this picture. But I'm over here living in this fine palace facilitated by Hiram with the best of materials. And over there is the Ark of God housed in a tent. Something is not right here. It should be just the other way around. I think we can learn from that. That's just my view. You can buy it or you can ditch it as you see fit. Well, somebody will say, well, Jim, what about spending all that money helping the poor? Well, Jesus himself answered that when Mary anointed his feet with expensive ointment. You recall that some of his disciples thought, well, that's a waste. That money might have been put to better use as alms. One of those was Judas. Jesus rebuked them, you recall. His answer essentially was, look, you want to help the poor? Every day there's opportunity for you to do that. But this woman wants to honor me. You can honor the poor anytime you're good and ready. Nothing is stopping you, but it is right for her to do what she is doing. Honor me. Feed the poor, but honor God also, and that's the whole point. Sometimes to build down is just as bad as building up when we do it with the wrong motives. You see, when we convince ourselves that we can worship the Lord in a tent or a storefront, which is true, and we are content with it, not because it's the best we can do, but we can easily settle for a tent arrangement, so to speak, because, hey, quite honestly, we don't have a much higher view of the majesty and holiness of God than that. And we'd rather spend our money on our own paneled palaces and our gold-gilded chariots than invest them in a magnificent church more appropriate to our majestic God. See, I think today we just don't typically have a very high conception of God. I doubt that many of you would disagree with me. Our dumbed-down conceptions of worship styles, habits, and content tend to reflect that, in my opinion. What is in our heads, you see, tends to play out in our habits. You see, thinking of it that way starts to give us pause. At least, it does me. What I think we should say in this matter is that it is not that building up or building down, I'm talking about church construction right now, is right or wrong in itself. But the tail of the tape with God is the mindset we bring to either project. God is pleased with whichever way we go, so long as our design conforms to His Word and our desire is to honor Him. We could build a great cathedral as a monument to ourselves, and we can settle for a storefront because we have a low view of God and are unwilling to sacrifice for something more worthy of Him. I say again, we can run off the rails in either direction, depending on the motives driving us and the circumstances compelling us. But I know what I'd like to do, which is virtually impossible in these days. But it could be done if God's people were really willing to do it, would sacrifice to do it, and have the right spirit to do it. It could be done. Clearly, the Lord Himself was not insisting on a temple instead of a mobile tabernacle as a symbolic seat of His presence. In David's case, the vision for a temple to house the ark associated with His presence was David's sense of the greatness and glory of God and David's humility. David felt that it was unfitting for him to live in a palace surrounded by regal glory, verse 2, while the symbolic place of God's presence was nothing more than a glorified tent. And out of his high sense of the glory of God, David wanted to house the ark in a way, to his mind, more symbolically reflective of the transcendence of the otherness of Israel's invisible king. But the Lord lets it be known by implication that His glory and greatness is not so small that it is at the mercy of any kind of physical dwelling that David might create, which is why the Lord had not made an issue of it. For if His symbolic dwelling place was to be construed as any measure of His inscrutable glory and majesty, nothing we could build could ever do God justice. It would become an idol. But what pleased God, really pleased God, was David's humble motive and the king's desire to honor God above himself. Now that warms the heart of God. And that spirit God honored with a covenant with David about David's dynasty and everlasting throne. David was intent on making God's name great, and the Lord graciously responded with a promise that He would make David's name great. Again, that motif runs all through these narratives. I've hit it over and over again. God loves to honor those who honor Him. He's not obliged to. God owes us nothing. But God, in His grace and His mercy, just delights to honor those who honor Him, and He dead sure will dishonor those who dishonor Him. God honors those who honor Him not because, I repeat, we earn His favor, but because He mercifully and graciously just delights to show it. Secondly, Nathan is a good example here of how we can be so well-meaning about honoring God, but actually be mistaken about the way to do it. Nathan, the prophet, was a man of God to the bone. He was a faithful and fearless prophet. He was a man, as we will see later, could look a king in the eye, one like David. When David was dead wrong, Nathan could look him in the eye and boldly reprove his sin with a, "Thou art the man." However, folks, the most earnest of godly servants can be wrong if they're not careful to submit these decisions to God. Nathan here, well-meaning as he was just so sure that this would please God that he got ahead of God in approving David's building project. And the Lord spoke to him that night, as we see. Nathan had to retract his original go-ahead to David. The Lord revealed to Nathan in the night that David, because he was a man of war, would give God's temple the wrong face as its builder. So God ordained that that job, building him a temple, to which he was going to give the okay, but not now, would be reserved for David's son and immediate successor, Solomon, who would be a man of peace. Symbolism seems to mean more to God than it means to some of us, I think. David had his calling of God, and his particular calling required David to deal with all of the enemies that surrounded God's people, and in the process shed a lot of blood. His name became almost synonymous with a warrior, and God is indeed sometimes just that. Sometimes he's even called a warrior. When he sets out to deal with the wicked, in a world of sin and darkness, that just has to be. But fundamentally, God is a God of peace, not of war. God is a God of mercy, a God of grace, a God of forgiveness, a God of loving kindness. It was more fitting for David's son to build the temple of God, because in Solomon's reign, there would be continuing peace. So in response to David's good intentions about building a temple as a permanent housing for the Ark of God, the Lord makes a covenant with David. Elsewhere, as I mentioned, referred to as the sure mercies of David, or meaning the mercies God firmly pledged to David and his house as a result of his divine favor. In his ascension to the throne of Israel, through Nathan the prophet, the Lord declares that David is where he is, and he is who he is, by the grace and sovereign choice of God. The Lord will not allow that perspective to be obscured. When David was just a humble boy and had done nothing to earn any merit with God, God reminds David, we all need to be reminded of God's grace and mercy, I took you from the pasture, from following sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. This was God's work, not David's work. He ascended by the power of God, not the power of David. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. What is the connection between David's intention to build a temple for the Lord and this response accentuating God's grace and sovereignty in elevating David to the throne of Israel and giving him all of his military successes? On the surface, it's not obvious, at least to me. It almost sounds like a light reproof. Here, I think, is probably the answer. Even in the greatest of saints, there is a taint of the flesh, even in our best intentions. It is possible that in David's design here, honorable as it was, the Lord may have seen, as only he can, a little seed of corruption. What might that have been? Just possibly a little touch of legalism so endemic to our fallen human nature. I will do this for you, Lord, so you will keep doing all these good things for me that you've been doing. I definitely want you on my side. That might have been somewhere in David's mind. Well, is there anything wrong with that? Only if we have any notion in our heads that we earn credit with God by piling up our merit badges. Yes, God honors those, as I said, who honor him, but never, never, never because we deserve it or have earned it in any way. And just as I said earlier, just because he delights to do so, as in the case of David, not because he's obliged to. David is doing a good thing here, but the Lord's questions that follow and the strong emphasis on his grace and sovereignty in promoting David and making him successful suggest to me that there may have been a little taint of legalism in David's proposal, and the Lord wanted to uproot that little potentially corrupting seed. David had been obedient to God, unlike Saul. That faithful obedience was all to the good, provided that David entertained no notion that he was piling up merit before God that obligated God to keep blessing him. Anytime we go there, we're going the wrong place. Faith-driven obedience God desires, but never let us imagine that we're storing up merit with God that obliges him to honor us. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.